Tom, there's a beautiful sycamore tree on the cover of your book, The Star in the Sycamore. There's a story, isn't there, about this tree and how it led to stargazing?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I think it was stargazing that led me to the tree. As I explain in an essay in the book, one night I was taking my dog out to the barn, which I did every night. It was this ritual. I had to look up at the stars, and it was a clear night, and I said, "Oh, that's a Big Dipper up there." And I looked behind me. That's Orion's Belt. And after that, I realized I was really woefully ignorant on the night sky, the constellations up there. And it struck me that I'd paid so much attention to things on Earth. I'm interested in, the native habitat, the plants, the trees, and everything. But here's virtually the entire universe overhead. I just overlooked it, and that led me to really get into stargazing as a practice, as a way to learn more about the night sky. And I also, because you live in winter in Michigan, when I get home from work, sometimes I'll take a walk down our dark country road at night. And I noticed the trees at night, they really, when they're bare as they are, they really show the form that they've taken, throughout their, by turning themselves and growing or orienting themselves basically toward the light. And there's this one tree in particular, and it's a sycamore that's on the cover of the book. And it's just beautiful. It has its arms lifted up. I just call them arms. They remind me of sort of like the touchdown Jesus statue down at Notre Dame on the side of the Hesburgh Library. And this one night when I walked back, I could see Sirius, the dog star. It was just nestled on the crown of this tree. And it made me think about the connection between trees and stars. And of course, trees are nothing more than light incarnate. Every tree that was ever made has grown and turned itself, and its form has been shaped in response to the sun, which is our star. And that was really the inspiration for the title of the book.
And I understand in this collection of essays, you also talk about how light affects human beings.
Yeah, and I think the way that certainly we all know this time of the year, we're in the darkest, shortest nights of the year, although it's starting to get brighter, is that people respond differently in the summer. I mean, you need less sleep, at least I do. I remember visiting my sister and brother-in-law once up in Alaska, land in the midnight sun, and it was middle of the summer, and it seems like people were up cooking, playing softball and everything, and getting by in 3-4 hours of sleep, and it didn't bother them. But of course, now, the way it is dark in the winter, about 8 or 8:30, sometimes I'm ready to pack it in. But I think we need that light in our lives, and I think that's the light that nature can provide. It's both the visual light, but it's also the insights into the way the natural world works that is so fascinating, life-affirming, because we come from nature, and that exposing us to the light of the knowledge of nature is really a powerful way to grow it in our own right.
And you live out in Three Rivers, I believe, right? On a farm?
Right.
So tell us the story of that farm. And is that the first time you've lived in country, or you have always? Because when I moved out to the country, one of the very first things I discovered was the sky. When you get out of suburbia and the city, there's so much sky and you see so many more stars.
I think that was certainly the case here. My wife and I moved out in the country after we married. And we moved in this place in 1995. It's an old brick farmhouse built in the 1860s. And it had been owned by a couple who had lived here for 51 years and had never moved. Matter of fact, before the husband went into the hospital for a couple weeks before his death, he never hardly went anywhere. I mean, he had a small dairy farm. So it's this beautiful old home. And we came into it. And I remember what you mentioned in terms of, I remember that first night walking down the road, it was late summer, and seeing that river of the Milky Way overhead. I'd never seen it so clear. And I was like, wow, I'm really in a different place. Even though I grew up in 3 or 5 miles away, the rural setting, the quietude, the darkness, the sky, it was all something I hadn't really experienced before.
So give us a synopsis, if you can pull all those essays together. What is this book about? Obviously, nature.
Yeah, The Star in the Sycamore, it's really about paying attention with what I call the wild nearby. It's these natural wonders that are right in our midst that we may drive past every day or walk past every day without giving much thought. It can be a quiet little woods down the street or a park or a parcel of restored prairie or a favorite tree or a beach or a little spot on the river that really is abundant in life in a way that we have in Southwest Michigan because of the four seasons. There's always new growth and new change. But I think too often we think that we don't look at the wild nearby. We tend to look at the wild far away. We think, well, I'm going to go on vacation to the Rockies or the UP or out west. I'm going to go to a national park. I'm going to see the natural world in all its splendor. And that's great and that's wonderful. But on a daily basis, having regular encounters with the natural world, even something as small as a tree or a plant or some sort of new wildflower. I think that can give our life meaning and relaxation in a way that, you know, we can't always put that off until the 2 weeks we get for vacation every year.
And one of the things about the pandemic that we've been going through and more or less a lockdown where we can't get away, you mentioned in your book that it's also been a time of rediscovering nature, perhaps for some people. Maybe not for you, you've been there all along, but for many people, if there's no place to go, you go out for a walk in nature.
Well, and I think it's really timely the book came out when it did in 2020. I mean, it took about 12 years to write, but The way it turned out, this is a time when we were all grounded by the pandemic and we were rediscovering the things around us. That includes parks, that includes backyards and picnics, places like the Kalamazoo Nature Center. And we were really looking anew at these wonderful local places. And in some cases, people are saying, how did I miss this? I want to make this part of my daily return, part of my daily life. And I think that's led to this rediscovery, and I think it's going to continue long after the pandemic ends.
That would be a benefit, yeah, if we could rediscover it and love it better than we obviously have. In fact, I'm wondering, with climate change, do you think people may notice it more now that they've been out in nature, that things are changing?
I compare getting used to nature and learning more about it the way we may develop a taste for craft beer or wood-fired pizza after we've had something that we really like and enjoy. It's the same thing with an experience in nature that we haven't seen or endured before. Maybe it's a bee tree. It's a wild tree that a beehive is growing in. Or maybe it's looking and finding a new place where there's ripe black raspberries in our neighborhood or wild strawberries. I mean, once you've had these encounters, it changes us. It makes us look differently at things, just like a little bit of knowledge about, you know, these ancient bur oaks that are still around the streets of Kalamazoo that my friend, the artist Ladislav Hanka, does such a wonderful job of illustrating. You know, once we see these things and get to know them, then it changes our perspective. I don't think there's no turning back. And especially with climate change, I think the more we're out in nature, the more we'll see the subtle changes that have been brought about by some of the warming temperatures and the different changes that's caused in our environment.
And one of the details that it seems you've noticed being out in the country more is that there are more than four seasons. I found that kind of fascinating, that you're looking at it as more like seven. And I think you're right. Talk to us about seven seasons.
Well, I mean, the four seasons are very arbitrary. It's just one example by time. Most of us don't think summer starts June 21st, but after June 21st, the days actually start getting shorter. But we all have our markers. I mean, you think about the spring when you first see those first grape hyacinths pop out of your flower beds, or the tulips that are starting to come up, those green spears, the tulips that looks like the snow is going to kill them because it's so cold, it never does. Or if you're out in the marsh, you see the marsh marigold or the skunk cabbage. So nature is constantly changing. I mean, even in February, early March, you see the tips of the maple trees start to turn red. They're starting to get that sap. These changes are subtle. So the big four arbitrary markers, they don't really define all the small little revelations that are coming about across the year. Or one that I like, the first time in the spring when you're driving down the road, you smell a skunk. I mean, that's an indicator of spring too, right? These critters are out moving around.
Well, I've long thought that there are these transient seasons, which I guess ends up being the same thing you're saying between winter and spring. There's this mud season. We think of green in spring, but there's this mud season after the snow melts and before the green really starts popping out. And there's a transient season between fall and winter when the leaves are down and there's a brownness before the white comes in. So I think I've been thinking the same thing. I just never called it different seasons.
I think the Native Americans had names for the different
moons.
Did they? We just saw a beautiful moon last week, which is the wolf moon.
Yeah.
And that was probably, obviously, they're more in tune to the natural environment. But looking at the moon as an indicator of where the cycle's moving is probably more precise.
You're right. And then you talk about animals in some of these essays as well. And there's one that talks about the difference between city dogs and country dogs. Do explain.
Yeah, that's probably, that could be probably for some people. I don't mean to, let me just put it this way. When I was a kid, even city dogs lived in a certain way. I think dogs lived in the backyard. They had a doghouse. They had names like, you know, Fido or Skipper or Buddy or Spot or something like that, non-human names.
Yeah.
They ate they canned dog food, which Lord knows where that stuff came from. But I think their place in the social status was different. They were outdoor animals for most of us. They lived outdoors and we loved them, but they hadn't crossed the threshold literally into our homes. And I think the way people, the way we live now, our animals have taken much more of a personal, you know, spot in the family. I mean, they were, there's a, I don't know, 50, 60% of people say that their dogs sleep with them. We refer to ourselves as pet parents. And that's good. Certainly, I love dogs. You see more dog parks than you used to. And I think you see more people who are single. That dog is taking up a role. And I was single for a while myself before I got married. But I think country dogs really harken back to some of those older traits. And as a guy who's lived out in the country, had a dog that lived in a barn or dogs that spend more time outside, I think they live a more liberated existence. I mean, we have 4 acres. I'm able to walk my dog on my paths. Dogs do the business where they do it. I don't have to follow behind with the little green plastic glove and do the duty that household dog owners do. Every now and then they'll find something that they'll roll in, or sometimes they'll get hold of some little wild thing, and it's a sad moment, but they're just dogs being dogs, right? So I think when I talk about country dogs, it's dogs that probably have a little bit harsher environment, but they're really native instincts. We allow them to develop a little bit fuller than you can when you have a city dog that's got to be on a leash every time it goes outside and, you know, just doesn't get to encounter the natural world in the way that a country dog does on a pretty regular basis.
I definitely saw that when I moved from suburbia into the country, that my dog moving with me developed an entirely different personality, a much freer and happier one, I'd have to say. And I wonder if people are the same way. What do you think? Moving from city into the country and having more room to move around.
Well, I think certainly moving from the city in the country, one of the first things you're going to notice is the quiet. And it's both an external quiet in terms of the decibel level that we have, but it's also an internal quiet because the visual noise that you have in the city with everything, whether it's a bright sign or traffic or a man-made built environment, it's more absent, you know, in the country. And even if you're looking across a corner soybean field or you're walking in a small woods, you know, the shapes and forms and smells, your senses are more engaged in the natural world. And it's a natural world that we have all evolved, you know, to live in. By the way, I mean, the last 150 years of the Industrial Revolution, what's that's brought in terms of our technology and the impact on our senses, it's still not natural. We still struggle with that as people. And I think that's why, you know, we have some of the anxiety we have and some of the stress we have to deal with, because it's our bodies trying to say, wait, you know, these machines, they're hammering away at me. I need some peace and quiet. And I think the country offers that to people. And whether you live there or whether you just like to visit it frequently.
And in fact, I was thinking, too, in thinking about your book and how you moved to this old farmhouse in Three Rivers, what have you discovered about sense of place or being in one place for a long time? And that could be city or country or anywhere, and having the ability to put roots down. Because I think right now we live in a society where people move every few years, whether it's for job transfers or whatever, we're farther away from family. How important have you found it to be in a place where you have the time and the ability to set down roots?
Well, I think roots are greatly enriching. I'm fortunate that all the time I've lived here, 26 years in this farmhouse, my brother and his wife and family lived about 100 yards down the road in another old brick farmhouse about the same age. And so we've been close to family. Probably the first feeling that I had of putting down roots when I started planting trees in the property, I planted about, I don't know, about 250, 300 trees, 40, 45 different species.
Oh, good for you.
These little trees are the size of a pencil at first, right? And the rabbits can chew them down, and the mice, and it's this major catastrophe. But slowly you put tubes around them, protect them, they start to grow up, and they till they're at the point where they can't be damaged. To see some of those trees now, they're 20 foot, 25, 30 feet tall and producing acorns and hickory nuts and pine cones that are themselves reseeding. I mean, that's deeply gratifying. But I think there's a flip side of that too. And is that if you stay in the same place so long, and I mentioned this in one of my essays, you can get what's called root bound. And you may have bought one of those perennial plants at a garden store in the fall that's we're going to sell it a third off, and you take that plastic pot off and it's become like a sarcophagus. The roots are all so tightly formed in there that to go plant them, you've got to break them loose and let those roots find some new growth. And I think that's what I struggle with sometimes. And that's what my encounters with nature help me do, is continue to grow and learn, because I you can take any place for granted. So being rooted means that you've also got to find new ways where you can grow and extend yourself, at least for me, to keep that fresh. But overwhelmingly, yeah, to see the seasons change, and to see your life and your family grow up, and see how you've changed in relation to your home, it's a very meaningful way of life.
Well, and I certainly don't think that it means staying home all the time. I think having that place where you have deep roots also gives you the freedom and ability to explore the world, knowing you can always come back to that oasis.
Yeah, certainly. And I think with this book, I had a commute, 45, 50-minute commute to Battle Creek for, I worked for the Kellogg Foundation for 27 years, wonderful place to work. And then I retired from there in 2016, and I took another job down at the University of Notre Dame, and that was even a farther commute, the opposite direction.
Wow.
And after that position closed in 2 years, I sort of came home in 2018 and started working full-time at home, and I realized that I had never really spent more than a week at home on what we now call a staycation. And that would be sometimes I would take a week to finish up some house project or outdoor project. It wasn't just to be home and really immerse myself. So I did, after 25 years, have this sense of rediscovery where I'm working at my desk and all of a sudden, hey, I can just pop outside every hour and a half and take a little 5-minute mini walk and just get this recharged sense of seeing what new buds have come up, or what new wildflowers, or what the animal has been chewing on. And I think that was only heightened during the pandemic, when a lot of us started to do that. You know, we got a chance to go out every day on a repeated basis.
Yeah.
See how the world was unfolding around us.
So you have an event coming up in Kalamazoo at This Is a Bookstore. Some of us know it as Book Bug as well. And it's, as many events are right now, a virtual event of local authors. Tell us about that event and what you plan to bring to it.
Well, there's going to be four local authors at the event, and I've been reading about their bios. It's fascinating, diverse range of writing in terms of fiction and nonfiction. I think my part of it, because I'm writing about the natural world, they want us to talk about where this book came from. And I think maybe, I don't know if it's going to be easier for me, but I think it really falls in line with what we saw in 2020. This idea that, you know, paying attention to the natural world, paying attention to the wild nearby, finding as part of a daily practice, just the way some people make exercise or yoga or meditation or prayer practice. How can we incorporate the natural world into the daily habits and really ways we have of being? And I just want to get the word out about that. And I think whether or not people buy my book, That's such a hopeful direction, I think, for our country to go to. We so much need peace. We need to calm our nerves that have been rough raw in so many ways. And I just want to reinvigorate that sense of hope with the new year and with spring coming up. And hopefully my book can help play a little part in that revival. That would be wonderful.
Well, thank you for spending a few minutes with us, Tom. We appreciate it. And we'll look for you on the 25th online. And we'll look for your book on the bookshelf, The Star is the Sycamore.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the opportunity and all the good work that WMUK does.